honor of my realm, won't you? You can ride the pig.
The laughter crashed over him like a wave. Tyrion Lannister did not remember rising, nor climbing on his chair, but he found himself standing on the table. The hall was a torch-lit blur of leering faces. He twisted his face into the most hideous mockery of a smile the Seven Kingdoms had ever seen.
"Your Grace," he called, "I'll ride the pig, but only if you ride the dog."
Joffrey scowled, confused.
"Me? I'm no dwarf. Why me?"
"Step right into the cut, Joff."
"Why? You're the only man in the hall that I'm certain of defeating."
He could not have said which was sweeter. The instant of shocked silence, the gale of laughter that followed, or the look of blind rage on his nephew's face. The dwarf hopped back to the floor well satisfied, and by the time he looked back, Sir Osmond and Sir Meron were helping Joff climb down as well. When he noticed Cersei glaring at him, Tyrion blew her a kiss. It was a relief when the musicians began to play. The tiny jousters led Dog and Sow from the hall, the guests returned to their trenches of brawn, and Tyrion called for another cup of wine. But suddenly he felt Sir Garland's hand on his sleeve.
"My lord, beware," the knight warned. "The king."
Tyrion turned in his seat. Joffrey was almost upon him, red-faced and staggering, wine slopping over the rim of the great golden wedding chalice he carried in both hands.
"Your Grace,"
was all he had time to say before the king upended the chalice over his head. The wine washed down over his face in a red torrent. It drenched his hair, stung his eyes, burned in his wound, ran down his cheeks, and soaked the velvet of his new doublet.
"How'd you like that, imp?"
Joffrey mocked. Tyrion's eyes were on fire. He dabbed at his face with the back of a sleeve and tried to blink the world back into clarity.
"That was ill done, Your Grace,"
he heard Sir Garland say quietly.
"Not at all, Sir Garland."
Tyrion dare not let this grow any uglier than it was, not here, with half the realm looking on.
"Not every king would think to honour a humble subject by serving him from his own royal chalice. A pity the wine spilled."
"It didn't spill," said Joffrey, too graceless to take the retreat Tyrion offered him.
"And I wasn't serving you either."
Queen Margaery appeared suddenly at Joffrey's elbow.
"My sweet king," the Tyrell girl entreated, "come, return to your place. There's another singer waiting."
"Alaric of Eisen," said Lady Olenna Tyrell, leaning on her cane and taking no more notice of the wine-soaked dwarf than her granddaughter had done. "I do so hope he plays us a range of Castamere. It has been an hour. I've forgotten how it goes."
"Sir Adam has a toast he wants to make as well," said Margaery. "Your Grace, please."
"I have no wine," Joffrey declared. "How can I drink a toast if I have no wine? Uncle Imp, you can serve me. Since you won't joust, you'll be my cupbearer."
"I would be most honored."
"It's not meant to be an honor," Joffrey screamed. "Bend down and pick up my chalice."
Tyrion did as he was bid, but as he reached for the handle, Joff kicked the chalice through his legs.
"Pick it up. Are you as clumsy as you are ugly?"
He had to crawl under the table to find the thing.
"Good. Now fill it with wine."
He claimed a flagon from a serving girl and filled the goblet three-quarters full.
"No, on your knees, dwarf."
Kneeling, Tyrion raised up the heavy cup, wondering if he was about to get a second bath. But Joffrey took the wedding chalice one-handed, drank deep, and set it on the table.
"You can get up now, uncle."
His legs cramped as he tried to rise and almost spilt him again. Tyrion had to grab hold of a chair to steady himself. Sir Garland lent him a hand. Joffrey laughed, and Cersei as well, then others. He could not see who, but he heard them.
"Your Grace,"
Lord Tywin's voice was impeccably correct.
They are bringing in the pie. Your sword is needed.
The pie? Joffrey took his queen by the hand. Come, my lady, it's the pie.
The guests stood, shouting and applauding, and smashing their wine cups together as the great pie made its slow way down the length of the hall, wheeled along by a half-dozen beaming cooks. 2 yards across it was, crusty and golden brown, and they could hear squeaks and thumpings coming from inside it. Tyrion pulled himself back into his chair. All he needed now was for a dove to shit on him, and his day would be complete. The wine had soaked through his doublet and small clothes, and he could feel the wetness against his skin. He ought to change, but no one was permitted to leave the feast until the time came for the bedding ceremony. That was still a good 20 or 30 dishes off, he judged. King Joffrey and his queen met the pie below the dais. As Joffrey drew his sword, Margaery laid a hand on his arm to restrain him. Widow's wail was not meant for slicing pies.
True! Joffrey lifted his voice. Sir Ilion, your sword!
From the shadows at the back of the hall, Sir Ilion Payne appeared.
The spectre at the feast,
thought Tyrion as he watched the King's Justice stride forward, gaunt and grim. He had been too young to have known Sir Ilion before he'd lost his tongue.
He would have been a different man in those days, but now the silence is as much a part of him as those hollow eyes, that rusty chainmail shirt, and the great sword on his back.
Sir Ilion bowed before the King and Queen, reached back over his shoulder, and drew forth 6 feet of ornate silver bright with runes. He knelt to offer the huge blade to Joffrey, hilt first. Points of red fire winked from the ruby eyes on the pommel, a chunk of dragon glass carved in the shape of a grinning skull. Sansa stirred in her seat. What sword is that? Tyrion's eyes still stung from the wine. He blinked and looked again. Sir Ilion's great sword was as long and wide as ice, but it was too silvery bright. Valyrian steel had a darkness to it, a smokiness in its soul. Sansa clutched his arm. What has Sir Ilion done with my father's sword?
I should have sent ice back to Robb Stark, Tyrion thought.
He glanced at his father, but Lord Tywin was watching the king. Joffrey and Margaery joined hands to lift the great sword and swung it down together in a silvery arc. When the pie crust broke, the doves burst forth in a swirl of white feathers, scattering in every direction, flapping for the windows and the rafters. A roar of delight went up from the benches, and the fiddlers and pipers in the gallery began to play a sprightly tune. Joff took his bride in his arms and whirled her around merrily. A serving man placed a slice of hot pigeon pie in front of Tyrion and covered it with a spoon of lemon cream. The pigeons were well and truly cooked in this pie, but he found them no more appetizing than the white ones fluttering about the hall. Sansa was not eating either.
"You're deathly pale, my lady," Tyrion said. "You need a breath of cool air, and I need a fresh doublet."
He stood and offered her his hand. "Come." But before they could make their retreat, Joffrey was back.
"Uncle, where are you going? You're my cup-bearer, remember?"
I need to change into fresh garb, your grace. May I have your leave?
No. I like the look of you this way. Serve me my wine.
The king's chalice was on the table where he'd left it. Tyrion had to climb back onto his chair to reach it. Joff yanked it from his hands and drank long and deep, his throat working as the wine ran purple down his chin.
My lord, Margaery said, we should return to our places. Lord Buckler wants to toast us.
My uncle hasn't eaten his pigeon pie.
Holding the chalice one-handed, Joffrey jammed his other into Tyrion's pie.
It's ill luck not to eat the pie,
he scolded as he filled his mouth with hot spice pigeon.
See, it's good.
Spitting out flakes of crust, he coughed and helped himself to another fistful.
Dry, though. Needs washing down.
Joff took a swallow of wine and coughed again, more violently.
I want to see... see you ride that... pig, Uncle. I want...
His words broke up in a fit of coughing. Marjorie looked at him with concern.
Your Grace? It's the pie, not pie.
Joff took another drink, or tried to, but all the wine came spewing back out when another spate of coughing doubled him over. His face was turning red.
I can't...
The chalice slipped from his hand, and dark red wine went running across the dais.
He's choking,
Queen Marjorie gasped. Her grandmother moved to her side.
Help the poor boy!
The Queen of Thorns screeched in a voice 10 times her size.
Dolts, will you all stand about gaping? Help your king!
Sir Garland shoved Tyrion aside and began to pound Joffrey on the back. Sir Osmond Kettleblack ripped open the king's collar. A fearful, high, thin sound emerged from the boy's throat. The sound of a man trying to suck a river through a reed. Then it stopped, and that was more terrible still.
Turn him over!
Mace Tyrell bellowed at everyone and no one.
Turn him over and shake him by the heels! A different voice was calling. Water! Give him some water!
The High Septon began to pray loudly. Grand Maester Pycelle shouted for someone to help him back to his chambers to fetch his potions. Joffrey began to claw at his throat, his nails tearing bloody gouges in the flesh. Beneath the skin, the muscles stood out hard as stone. Prince Tommen was screaming and crying.
He's going to die,
Tyrion realized. He felt curiously calm, though pandemonium raged all about him. They were pounding Joff on the back again, but his face was only growing darker. Dogs were barking, children were wailing, men were shouting useless advice at each other. Half the wedding guests were on their feet, some shoving at each other for a better view, others rushing for the doors in their haste to get away. Sir Meron pried the king's mouth open to jam a spoon down his throat. As he did, the boy's eyes met Tyrion's.
He has Jaime's eyes.
Only had never seen Jaime look so scared.
The boy is only 13.
Joffrey was making a dry, clacking noise, trying to speak. His eyes bulged white with terror, and he lifted a hand, reaching for his uncle or pointing.
Is he begging my forgiveness, or does he think I can save him?
No, Cersei wailed. Father, help him! Someone help him! My son! My son!
Tyrion found himself thinking of Robb Stark.
My own wedding is looking much better in hindsight.
He looked to see how Sansa was taking this, but there was so much confusion in the hall that he could not find her. But his eyes fell on the wedding chalice, forgotten on the floor. He went and scooped it up. There was still a half inch of deep purple wine in the bottom of it. Tyrion considered it for a moment, then poured it on the floor. Marjorie Tyrell was weeping in her grandmother's arms as the old lady said,
"Be brave, be brave."
Most of the musicians had fled, but one last flautist in the gallery was blowing a dirge. In the rear of the throne room, scuffling had broken out around the doors, and the guests were trampling on each other. Sir Adam's gold cloaks moved in to restore order. Guests were rushing headlong out into the night, some weeping, some stumbling and retching, others white with fear. It occurred to Tyrion belatedly that it might be wise to leave himself. When he heard Cersei scream, he knew that it was over.
I should leave. Now.
Instead, he waddled toward her. His sister sat in a puddle of wine, cradling her son's body. Her gown was torn and stained, her face white as chalk. A thin black dog crept up beside her, sniffing at Joffrey's corpse.
"The boy is gone, Cersei,"
Lord Tywin said. He put his gloved hand on his daughter's shoulder as one of his guardsmen shooed away the dog.
Unhand him now. Let him go.
She did not hear. It took two king's guard to pry loose her fingers, so the body of King Joffrey Baratheon could slide limp and lifeless to the floor. The High Septon knelt beside him.
Father above, judge our good King Joffrey justly, he intoned, beginning the prayer for the dead.
Margaery Tyrell began to sob, and Tyrion heard her mother, Lady O'Leary, say,
He choked, sweetling. He choked on the pie. It was naught to do with you. He choked. We all saw.
He did not choke. Cersei's voice was sharp as Sir Ilion's sword. My son was poisoned. She looked to the White Knight standing helplessly around her. Kingsguard, do your duty.
My lady,
said Sir Loras Tyrell, uncertain.
Arrest my brother,
she commanded him.
He did this, the dwarf, him, and his little wife. They killed my son, your king. Take them both.
Daenerys. When the battle was done, Dany rode her silver through the fields of the dead. Her handmaids and the men of her cars came after, smiling and jesting among themselves. Dothraki hooves had torn the earth and trampled the rye and lentils into the ground, while arracks and arrows had sown a terrible new crop and watered it with blood. Dying horses lifted their heads and screamed at her as she rode past. Wounded men moaned and prayed. Jacaran moved among them. The Mercy men, with their heavy axes, taking a harvest of heads from the dead and dying alike. After them would scurry a flock of small girls, pulling arrows from the corpses to fill their baskets. Last of all, the dogs would come sniffing, lean and hungry, the feral pack that was never far behind the Khalasar. The sheep had been dead longest. There seemed to be thousands of them, black with flies, arrow shafts bristling from each carcass. Karl Ogre's riders had done that, Danny knew. No man of Drogo's Khalasar would be such a fool as to waste his arrows on sheep when there were shepherds yet to kill. The town was afire, black plumes of smoke roiling and tumbling as they rose into the hard blue sky. Beneath broken walls of dried mud, riders galloped back and forth, swinging their long whips as they herded the survivors from the smoking rubble. The women and children of Ogre's Khalasar walked with sullen pride, even in defeat and bondage. They were slaves now, but they seemed not to fear it. It was different with the townsfolk. Dany pitied them. She remembered what terror felt like. Mothers stumbling along with blank, dead faces, pulling sobbing children by the hand. There were only a few men among them, cripples and cowards and grandfathers. Sir Jorah said the people of this country name themselves the Lazarene, but the Dothraki call them Heishraki, the Lamb Men. Once Dany might have taken them for Dothraki, for they had the same copper skin and almond-shaped eyes. Now they looked alien to her, squat and flat-faced, their black hair cropped unnaturally short. They were herders of sheep and eaters of vegetables, and Khal Drogo said they belonged south of the river bend. The grass of the Dothraki Sea was not meant for sheep. Dany saw one boy bolt and run for the river. A rider cut him off and turned him, and the others boxed him in, cracking their whips in his face, running him this way and that. One galloped behind him, lashing him across the buttocks until his thighs ran red with blood. Another snared his ankles with a lash and sent him sprawling. Finally, when the boy could only crawl, they grew bored of the sport and put an arrow through his back. Sir Jorah met her outside the shattered gate. He wore a dark green surcoat over his mail. His gauntlets, greaves, and great helm were dark grey steel. The Dothraki had mocked him for a coward when he donned his armour, but the knight had spit insults right back in their teeth. Tempers had flared, longswords had clashed with Arrak, and the rider, whose taunts had been loudest, had been left behind to bleed to death. Sir Jorah lifted the visor of his flat-topped great helm as he rode up.
"Your lord husband awaits you within the town."
Drogo took no harm.
"A few cuts," Sir Jorah answered. "Nothing of consequence. He slew two Carls this day, Carl Ogo first, and then the son, Fogo, who became Carl, when Ogo fell. His blood riders cut the bells from their hair, and now Carl Drogo's every step rings louder than before."
Ogo and his son had shared the high bench with her lord husband at the naming feast when Viserys had been crowned, but that was in Vaes Dothrak, beneath the Mother of Mountains, where every rider was a brother and all quarrels were put aside. It was different out in the grass. Ogo's Khalasar had been attacking the town when Khal Drogo caught him. She wondered what the Lamb men had thought when they first saw the dust of their horses from atop those cracked mud walls. Perhaps a few, the younger and more foolish, who still believed that the guards heard the prayers of desperate men, took it for deliverance. Across the road, a girl no older than Danny was sobbing in a high, thin voice as a rider shoved her over a pile of corpses face down and thrust himself inside her. Other riders dismounted to take their turns. That was the sort of deliverance the Dothraki brought the Lamb men. "I am the blood of the dragon," Daenerys Targaryen reminded herself as she turned her face away. She pressed her lips together and hardened her heart and rode on toward the gate.
"Most of Ogre's riders fled," Sir Jorah was saying. "Still, there may be as many as 10,000 captives."
Slaves, Danny thought. Khal Drogo would drive them downriver to one of the towns on Slaver's Bay. She wanted to cry, but she told herself she must be strong. "This is war. This is what it looks like. This is the price of the Iron Throne."
"I've told the Carl he ought to make for Meereen," Sir Jorah said. "They'll pay a better price than he'd get from a slaving caravan. Illyrio writes that they had a plague last year, so the Brussels are paying double for healthy young girls, and triple for boys under 10. If enough children survive the journey, the guild will buy us all the ships we need and hire a man to sail them."
Behind them, the girl being raped made a heart-rending sound, a long, sobbing wail that went on and on and on. Danny's hand clenched hard around the reins, and she turned the silver's head. "Make them stop," she commanded Sir Jorah.
"Khaleesi,"
the knight sounded perplexed. "You heard my word," she said. "Stop them." She spoke to her cars in the harsh accents of Dothraki. "Jogo, Quarrow, you will aid Sir Jorah. I want no rape." The warriors exchanged a baffled look. Jorah Mormont spurred his horse closer.
"Princess," he said, "you have a gentle heart, but you do not understand. This is how it has always been. Those men have shed blood for the Carl. Now they claim their reward."
Across the road, the girl was still crying, her high, sing-song tongue strange to Danny's ears. The first man was done with her now, and a second had taken his place.
"She is Lamb Girl," Quarro said in Dothraki.
"She is nothing, Khaleesi. The riders do her honour. The Lamb men lay with sheep, it is known."
"It is known," her handmaid Iri echoed.
"It is known," agreed Jogo, astride the tall grey stallion that Drogo had given him. "If her wailing offends your ears, Khaleesi, Jogo will bring you her tongue."
He drew his arrack. "I will not have her harmed," Danny said. "I claim her. Do as I command you, or Khal Drogo will know the reason why."
"Aye, Khaleesi," Jogo replied, kicking his horse.
Quarrow and the others followed his lead, the bells in their hair chiming. "Go with them," she commanded Ser Jorah.
As you command.
The knight gave her a curious look.
You are your brother's sister, in truth.
Viserys? She did not understand.
No, he answered. Rhaegar.
And galloped off. Danny heard Jogo shout. The rapers laughed at him. One man shouted back. Jogo's arrack flashed, and the man's head went tumbling from his shoulders. Laughter turned to curses as the horsemen reached for weapons, but by then Quaro, Aego, and Rakaro were there. She saw Aego point across the road to where she sat upon her silver. The riders looked at her with cold, black eyes. One spat. The others scattered to their mounts, muttering. All the while, the man atop the lamb girl continued to plunge in and out of her, so intent on his pleasure that he seemed unaware of what was going on around him. Ser Jorah dismounted and wrenched him off with a mail hand. The Dothraki went sprawling in the mud, bounced up with a knife in hand, and died with Aego's arrow through his throat. Mormont pulled the girl off the pile of corpses and wrapped her in his blood-splattered cloak. He led her across the road to Danny.
What do you want done with her?
The girl was trembling, her eyes wide and vague. Her hair was matted with blood. Doria, see to her hurts. You do not have a rider's look. Perhaps she will not fear you. The rest with me. She urged the silver through the broken wooden gate. It was worse inside the town. Many of the houses were afire, and the Jacaran had been about their grisly work. Headless corpses filled the narrow, twisty lanes. They passed other women being raped. Each time, Danny reined up, sent her cars to make an end to it, and claim the victim as slave. One of them, a thick-bodied, flat-nosed woman of 40 years, blessed Danny haltingly in the common tongue. But from the others she only got flat black stares. They were suspicious of her, she realized with sadness, afraid that she had saved them for some worse fate.
"You cannot claim them all, child," Ser Jorah said, the fourth time they stopped, while the warriors of her cars herded her new slaves behind her.
"I am Khaleesi, heir to the Seven Kingdoms, the blood of the dragon," Danny reminded him. "It is not for you to tell me what I cannot do." Across the city, a building collapsed in a great gout of fire and smoke, and she heard distant screams and the wailing of frightened children. They found Khal Drogo seated before a square, windowless temple with thick mud walls and a bulbous dome like some immense brown onion. Beside him was a pile of heads taller than he was. One of the short arrows of the lamb men stuck through the meat of his upper arm, and blood covered the left side of his bare chest like a splash of paint. His three blood riders were with him. Jiqui helped Danny dismount. She had grown clumsy as her belly grew larger and heavier. She knelt before the carl. "My son and stars is wounded." The arrack cut was wide but shallow. His left nipple was gone, and a flap of bloody flesh and skin dangled from his chest like a wet rag.
"Iskretch, moon of life, from Arrak of one blood rider to Khal Ogo,"
Khal Drogo said in the common tongue.
"I kill him for it, and Ogo too."
He turned his head, the bells in his braid ringing softly.
"Is Ogo you hear, and Fogo is Kalaka, who was Khal when I slew him."
"No man can stand before the son of my life," Danny said, "the father of the stallion who mounts the world." A mounted warrior rode up and vaulted from his saddle. He spoke to Hago, a stream of angry Dothraki too fast for Danny to understand. The huge blood rider gave her a heavy look before he turned to his Khal.
"This one is Mago, who rides in the cars of Kojako. He says the Khaleesi has taken his spoils, a daughter of the lambs who was his to mount."
Khal Drogo's face was still and hard, but his black eyes were curious as they went to Danny.
"Tell me the truth of this moon of my life,"
he commanded in Dothraki. Danny told him what she had done, in his own tongue so the Carl would understand her better, her words simple and direct. When she was done, Drogo was frowning.
"This is the way of war. These women are our slaves now, to do with as we please."
"It pleases me to hold them safe," Danny said, wondering if she had dared too much. "If your warriors would mount these women, let them take them gently and keep them for wives. Give them places in the Khalasar, and let them bear your sons." Kotho was ever the cruelest of the blood riders. It was he who laughed.
"Does the horse breed with the sheep?"
Something in his tone reminded her of Viserys. Danny turned on him angrily.
"The dragon feeds on horse and sheep alike."
Khal Drogo smiled.
"See how fierce she grows," he said. "It is my son inside her, the stallion who mounts the world, filling her with his fire. Ride slowly, Kotho. If the mother does not burn you where you sit, the son will trample you into the mud. And you, Mago, hold your tongue and find another lamb to mount. These belong to my Khaleesi."
He started to reach out a hand to Daenerys, but as he lifted his arm, Drogo grimaced in sudden pain and turned his head. Danny could almost feel his agony. The wounds were worse than Ser Jorah had led her to believe. "Where are the healers?" she demanded. The Khaleesi had two sorts, barren women and eunuch slaves. The herb women dealt in potions and spells, the eunuchs in knife, needle, and fire. "Why did they not attend the Khal?"
"The Khal sent the hairless men away, Khaleesi,"
old Kahalo assured her. Danny saw the blood rider had taken a wound himself, a deep gash in his left shoulder.
"Many riders are hurt,"
Khal Drogo said stubbornly.
"Let them be healed first. This arrow is no more than the bite of a fly. This little cut is only a new scar to boast of to my son."
Danny could see the muscles in his chest where the skin had been cut away. A trickle of blood ran from the arrow that pierced his arm. "It is not for Khal Drogo to wait," she proclaimed. "Jogo, seek out these eunuchs and bring them here at once."
"Silver Lady,"
a woman's voice said behind her,
"I can help the great rider with his hurts."
Danny turned her head. The speaker was one of the slaves she had claimed, the heavy, flat-nosed woman who had blessed her.
"The Khal needs no help from women who lie with sheep," barked Kotho. "Aego, cut out her tongue."
Aego grabbed her hair and pressed a knife to her throat. Danny lifted her hand. "No, she is mine. Let her speak." Aego looked from her to Kotho. He lowered his knife.
"I mean no wrong, fierce riders."
The woman spoke Dothraki well. The robe she wore had once been the lightest and finest of woolens, rich with embroidery, but now they were mud-caked and bloody and ripped. She clutched the torn cloth of her bodice to her heavy breast.
"I have some small skill in the healing arts."
"Who are you?" Danny asked her.
"I am named Miri Mazdur. I am God's wife of this temple."
"Meji,"
grunted Hago, fingering his arak. His look was dark. Danny remembered the word from a terrifying story that Jiqui had told her one night by the cook fire. A Meji was a woman who lay with demons and practiced the blackest of sorceries, a vile thing, evil and soulless, who came to men in the dark of night and sucked life and strength from their bodies.
"I am healer," Miri Mazdur said.
"A healer of sheeps," sneered Kotho. "Blood of my blood, I say, kill this Meji, and wait for the hairless men."
Danny ignored the blood rider's outburst. This old, homely, thick-bodied woman did not look like a Meji to her. "Where did you learn your healing, Miri Mazdur?"
My mother was God's wife before me, and taught me all the songs and spells most pleasing to the great shepherd, and how to make the sacred smokes and ointments from leaf and root and berry. When I was younger and more fair, I went in caravan to Ashai by the Shadow to learn from their mages. Ships from many lands come to Ashai, so I lingered long to study the healing ways of distant peoples. A moon singer at the Jogos Nai gifted me with her birthing songs. A woman of your own riding people taught me the magics of grass and corn and horse, and a maester from the Sunset Lands opened a body for me and showed me all the secrets that hide beneath the skin.
Sir Jorah Mormont spoke up.
A maester?
Marwyn, he named himself,
the woman replied in the common tongue.
From the sea beyond the sea, the seven lands, he said, Sunset Lands, where men are iron and dragons rule. He taught me this speech.
A maester in Ashai? Sir Jorah mused. Tell me, God's wife, what this Marwyn wear about his neck?
A chain so tight it was like to choke him, Iron Lord, with links of many metals.
The knight looked at Danny.
Only man, chain in the citadel of Old Town, wear such a chain, he said. And such men do know much of healing.
Why should you want to help my Carl?
All men are one flock, or so we are taught, replied Mira Mazdur. The great shepherd sent me to earth to heal his lambs, wherever I might find them.
Kotho gave her a stinging slap.
We are no sheep, Meiji.
Stop it, Danny said angrily. She is mine. I will not have her harmed. Khal Drogo grunted.
The arrow must come out, Kotho.
Yes, great rider,
Mira Mazdur answered, touching her bruised face.
And your breast must be washed and sewn, lest the wound festers.
Do it then, Khal Drogo commanded.
Great rider, the woman said, my tools and potions are inside the god's house, where the healing powers are strongest.
I will carry you, blood of my blood, Hago offered.
Khal Drogo waved him away.
I need no man's help, he said, in a voice proud and hard.
He stood unaided, towering over them all. A fresh wave of blood ran down his breast, from where Ogre's Arak had cut off his nipple. Danny moved quickly to his side. I am no man, she whispered, so you may lean on me. Drogo put a huge hand on her shoulder. She took some of his weight as they walked towards the great mud temple. The three blood riders followed. Danny commanded Sir Jorah and the warriors of her cars to guard the entrance and make certain no one set the building afire while they were still inside. They passed through a series of anterooms into the high central chamber under the onion. Faint light shone through the hidden windows above. A few torches burnt smokily from sconces on the walls. Sheepskins were scattered across the mud floor.
There,
Mira Mazdur said, pointing to the altar, a massive blue-veined stone carved with images of shepherds and their flocks. Khal Drogo lay upon it. The old woman threw a handful of dried leaves onto a brazier, filling the chamber with fragrant smoke.
Best if you wait outside, she told the rest of them.
We are blood of his blood, Kahalo said. Here we wait.
Kotho stepped close to Mira Mazdur.
Know this, wife of the Lamb God. Harm the Carl, and you suffer the same.
He drew his skinning knife and showed her the blade. She will do no harm. Danny felt she could trust this old, plain-faced woman with her flat nose. She had saved her from the hard hands of the rapers, after all.
If you must stay, then help,
Mira told the blood riders.
The great rider is too strong for me. Hold him still while I draw the arrow from his flesh.
She let the rags of her gown fall to her waist as she opened a carved chest and busied herself with bottles and boxes, knives and needles. When she was ready, she broke off the barbed arrowhead and pulled out the shaft, chanting in the sing-song tongue of the Lazarene. She heated a flagon of wine to boiling on the brazier and poured it over his wounds. Khal Drogo cursed her, but he did not move. She bound the arrow wound with a plaster of wet leaves and turned to the gash on his breast, smearing it with a pale green paste before she pulled the flap of the skin back in place. The Khal ground his teeth together and swallowed a scream. The guard's wife took out a silver needle and a bobbin of silk thread and began to close the flesh. When she was done, she painted the skin with red ointment, covered it with more leaves, and bound the breast in a ragged piece of lambskin.
"You must say the prayers I give you, and keep the lambskin in place for 10 days and 10 nights," she said. "There will be fever and itching, and a great scar when the healing is done."
Khal Drogo sat, bells ringing.
"I sing of my scars, sheep woman."
He flexed his arm and skull.
"Drink neither wine nor the milk of the puppy," she cautioned him. "Pain you will have, but you must keep your body strong to fight the poison spirits."
"I am Khal," Drogo said. "I spit on pain and drink what I like. Kohala, bring my vest."
The older man hastened off. "Before," Danny said to the ugly Lazarene woman, "I heard you speak of birthing songs."
"I know every secret of the bloody bed, Silver Lady, nor have I ever lost a babe,"
Miramar's door replied. "My time is near," Danny said. "I would have you attend me when he comes, if you would." Khal Drogo laughed.
"Moon of my life, you do not ask a slave. You tell her. She will do as you command."
He jumped down from the altar.
"Come, my blood. The stallions call. This place is ashes. It is time to ride."
Hago followed the Khal from the temple, but Kotho lingered long enough to favor Miramar's door with a stare.
"Remember, Meiji, as the Khal fares, so shall you."
"As you say, rider,"
the woman answered him, gathering up her jars and bottles.
"The great shepherd guards the flock."
Sansa. Far across the city, a bell began to toll. Sansa felt as though she were in a dream. "Joffrey is dead," she told the trees, to see if that would wake her. He had not been dead when she left the throne room. He had been on his knees, though, clawing at his throat, tearing at his own skin as he fought to breathe. The sight of it had been too terrible to watch, and she had turned and fled, sobbing. Lady Tanda had been fleeing as well.
"You have a good heart, my lady," she said to Sansa. "Not every maid would weep so for a man who set her aside and wed her to a dwarf."
"A good heart? I have a good heart?" Hysterical laughter rose up in her gullet, but Sansa choked it back down. The bells were ringing slow and mournful. Ringing, ringing, ringing. They had rung for King Robert the same way. Joffrey was dead. He was dead. He was dead, dead, dead. Why was she crying when she wanted to dance? Were they tears of joy? She found her clothes where she had hidden them, the night before last, with no maids to help her. It took her longer than it should have to undo the laces of her gown. Her hands were strangely clumsy, though she was not as frightened as she ought to have been.
"The gods are cruel to take him so young and handsome at his own wedding feast," Lady Tanda had said to her.
"The gods are just," thought Sansa. Rob had died at a wedding feast as well. It was Rob she wept for
him and Marjorie. Poor Marjorie, twice wed and twice widowed. Sansa slid her arm from a sleeve, pushed down the gown, and wriggled out of it. She balled it up and shoved it into the bowl of an oak, shook out the clothing she had hidden there. "Dress warmly," Sir Dontus had told her, "and dress dark." She had no blacks, so she chose a dress of thick brown wool. The bodice was decorated with freshwater pearls, though. "The cloak will cover them." The cloak was a deep green with a large hood. She slipped the dress over her head and donned the cloak, though she left the hood down for the moment. There were shoes as well, simple and sturdy, with flat heels and square toes. "The gods heard my prayer," she thought. She felt so numb and dreamy. "My skin has turned to porcelain, to ivory, to steel." Her hands moved stiffly, awkwardly, as if they had never let down her hair before. For a moment she wished Shay was there to help her with the knit. When she pulled it free, her long auburn hair cascaded down her back and across her shoulders. The web of spun silver hung from her fingers, the fine metal glimmering softly, the stones black in the moonlight. Black amethyst from a Shai. One of them was missing. Sansa lifted the net for a closer look. There was a dark smudge in the silver socket where the stone had fallen out. A sudden terror filled her. Her heart hammered against her ribs, and for an instant she held her breath. "Why am I so scared? It's only an amethyst. A black amethyst from a Shai, no more than that. It must have been loose in the setting, that's all. It was loose, and it fell out, and now it's lying somewhere in the throne room or in the yard, unless—" Sir Dontus had said the hairnet was magic, that it would take her home. He told her that she must wear it tonight at Joffrey's wedding feast. The silver wire stretched tight across her knuckles. Her thumb rubbed back and forth against the hole where the stone had been. She tried to stop, but her fingers were not her own. Her thumb was drawn to the hole as the tongue is drawn to a missing tooth. What kind of magic? The king was dead. The cruel king who had been her gallant prince 1,000 years ago. If Dontus had lied about the hairnet, had he lied about the rest as well? What if he never comes? What if there's no ship, no boat on the river, no escape? What would happen to her then? She heard a faint rustle of leaves and stuffed the silver hairnet down deep in the pocket of her cloak. "Who is there?" she cried. "Who is it?" The God's Wood was dim and dark, and the bells were ringing Joff into his grave. "Me." He staggered out from under the trees, reeling drunk. He caught her arm to steady himself. "Sweet Junkle, I've come. Your Florian has come. Don't be afraid." Sansa pulled away from his touch. "You said I must wear the hairnet. The silver net with the... what sort of stones are those?"
"Amethyst. Black amethyst from Ashai, my lady."
"They're no amethysts, are they? Are they? You lied."
"Black amethysts," he swore. "There was magic in them.
There was murder in them."
"Softly, my ladies, softly. No murder. He choked on his pigeon pie."
Dontus chortled.
"Oh, tasty, tasty pie. Silver and stones. That was all it was. Silver and stone and magic."
The bells were tolling, and the wind was making a noise like he had made as he tried to suck a breath of air. "You poisoned him. You did. You took a stone for my hair."
"Hush! You'll be the death of us. I did nothing. Come, we must away. They'll search for you. Your husband's been arrested."
"Tyrion?" she said, shocked.
"Do you have another husband? The imp, the dwarf uncle. She thinks he did it."
He grabbed her hand and pulled at her.
"This way. We must away. Quickly now. Have no fear."
Sansa followed, unresisting. "I can never abide the weeping of women," Joff once said, but his mother was the only woman weeping now. In old Nan stories, the Grumpkins crafted magic things that could make a wish come true. Did I wish him dead? She wondered before she remembered that she was too old to believe in Grumpkins. Tyrion poisoned him. Her dwarf husband had hated his nephew, she knew. Could he truly have killed him? Did he know about my hairnet? About the black amethyst? He brought Joff wine. How could you make someone choke by putting an amethyst in their wine? If Tyrion did it, they will think I was part of it as well, she realized with a start of fear. How not? They were man and wife, and Joffrey had killed her father and mocked her with her brother's death. One flesh, one heart, one soul.
Be quiet now, my sweetling, said Dontus. Outside the Godswood, we must make no sound. Pull up your hood and hide your face.
Sansa nodded and did as he said. He was so drunk that sometimes Sansa had to lend him her arm to keep him from falling. The bells were ringing out across the city, more and more of them joining in. She kept her head down and stayed in the shadows close behind Dontus. While descending the serpentine steps, he stumbled to his knees and retched. My poor Florian, she thought, as he wiped his mouth with a floppy sleeve. Dress dark, he'd said. Yet under his brown hooded cloak, he was wearing his old surcoat, red and pink horizontal stripes, beneath a black chief bearing three gold crowns, the arms of House Hollard. Why are you wearing your surcoat? Joff decreed it was death if you were caught dressed as a knight again. Nothing Joff had decreed mattered any longer.
I wanted to be a knight. For this, at least.
Dunters lurched back to his feet and took her arm.
Come, be quiet now. No questions.
They continued down the serpentine and across a small sunken courtyard. Sir Dunters shoved open a heavy door and lit a taper. They were inside a long gallery. Along the wall stood empty suits of armour, dark and dusty, their helms crested with rows of scales, that continued down their backs. As they hurried past, the taper's light made the shadows of each scale stretch and twist. The Hollow Knights are turning into dragons, she thought. One more stair took them to an oaken door banded with iron.
Be strong now, my gentle. You're almost there.
When Dontus lifted the bar and pulled open the door, Sansa felt the cold breeze on her face. She passed through 12 feet of wall, and then she was outside the castle, standing on the top of the cliff. Below was the river, above the sky, and one was as black as the other.
"We must climb down," Sir Dontus said. "At the bottom, a man is waiting to row us out to the ship."
"I'll fall." Bran had fallen, and he had loved to climb.
"No, you won't. There's a sort of ladder, a secret ladder, carved into the stone. Here, you can feel it, my lady."
He got down on his knees with her and made her lean over the edge of the cliff, groping with her fingers until she found the handhold cut into the face of the bluff.
"Almost as good as rungs."
Even so, it was a long way down.
"I can't. You must."
"Isn't there another way?"
"This is the way. It won't be so hard for a strong young girl like you. Hold on tight and never look down, and you'll be at the bottom in no time at all."
His eyes were shiny.
"Your poor Florian is fat and old and drunk. I'm the one should be afraid. I used to fall off my horse. Don't you remember? That was how we began. I was drunk and fell off my horse, and Joffrey wanted my full head, but you saved me. You saved me, sweetling."
He's weeping, she realized.
and now you have saved me. Only if you go, if not, I have killed us both.
It was him, she thought. He killed Joffrey.
She had to go, for him as much as herself. You go first, sir. If he did fall, she did not want him falling down on her head and knocking them both off the cliff.
As you wish, my lady.
He gave her a sloppy kiss and swung his legs clumsily over the precipice, kicking about until he found a foothold.
Let me get down a bit and come after. You will come now. You must swear it.
I'll come, she promised. Sir Dantas disappeared. She could hear him huffing and puffing as he began the descent. Sansa listened to the tolling of the bell, counting each ring. At 10, gingerly, she eased herself over the edge of the cliff, poking with her toes until they found a place to rest. The castle walls loomed large above her, and for a moment she wanted nothing so much as to pull herself up and run back to her warm rooms in the kitchen keep. Be brave, she told herself. Be brave, like a lady in a song. Sansa dared not look down. She kept her eyes on the face of the cliff, making certain of each step before reaching for the next. The stone was rough and cold. Sometimes she could feel her fingers slipping, and the handholds were not as evenly spaced as she would have liked. The bells would not stop ringing. Before she was halfway down, her arms were trembling, and she knew she was going to fall. One more step, she told herself. One more step. She had to keep moving. If she stopped, she would never start again, and Dawn would find her still clinging to the cliff, frozen in fear. One more step, and one more step. The ground took her by surprise. She stumbled and fell, her heart pounding. When she rolled onto her back and stared up at from where she had come, her head swam dizzily and her fingers clawed at the dirt.
I did it. I did it. I didn't fall. I made the climb, and now I'm going home.
Sir Dantas pulled her back onto her feet.
This way, quiet now. Quiet, quiet.
He stayed close to the shadows that lay black and thick beneath the cliffs. Thankfully, they did not have to go far. 50 yards downriver, a man sat in a small skiff, half hidden by the remains of a great galley that had gone aground there and burned. Dantas limped up to him, puffing.
Oswell, no names,
the man said.
In the boat.
He sat hunched over his oars, an old man, tall and gangling, with long white hair and a great hooked nose, with eyes shaded by a cowl.
Get in, and be quick about it,
he muttered.
We need to be away.
When both of them were safe aboard, the cowled man slid the blades into the water and put his back into the oars, rowing them out toward the channel. Behind them the bells were still tolling the boy king's death. They had the dark river all to themselves. With slow, steady, rhythmic strokes, they threaded their way downstream, sliding above the sunken galleys, past broken masts, burned hulls and torn sails. The oarlocks had been muffled, so they moved almost soundlessly. A mist was rising over the water. Sansa saw the embattled ramparts of one of the imp's winch towers looming above. But the great chain had been lowered, and they rowed unimpeded past the spot where 1,000 men had burned. The shore fell away. The fog grew thicker. The sound of the bells began to fade. Finally, even the lights were gone, lost somewhere behind them. They were out in Blackwater Bay, and the world shrank to dark water, blowing mist, and their silent companion stooped over the oars. How far must we go? She asked.
No talk.
The oarsman was old, but stronger than he looked, and his voice was fierce. There was something oddly familiar about his face, though Sansa could not say what it was.
Not far.
Sir Dantas took her hand in his own and rubbed it gently.
Your friend is near, waiting for you. No talk.
The oarsman growled again.
Sound carries over water, sir fool.